This is Mouth Media Network. Amplify and connect.
We are tired. And I'm not even half as tired as a lot of other people who have sort of multiple intersecting identities where, you know, I walk in the room and I'm a woman of color. So I'm managing not only being a woman in a sea of male leaders, but I'm also a person of color and dealing with microaggressions. And we're all sort of doing this work and we care and we're pushing our organizations and we're trying to educate and we're dealing with kind of hanging in there. You know, I think the bigger message now is that we all have this opportunity to, I like to say, many hands make light work.
For Jennifer Brown, it has always been about voice. From using her voice as a nonprofit activist, to performing on stage as a professional opera singer, to making sure all voices are heard in the workplace. Through her company, Jennifer Brown Consulting, and her recent book, How to Be an Inclusive Leader, she's educating employers so their teams can bring their full selves to work every day. There's a lot at stake in getting this right. Coming up, you'll hear what it was like for Jennifer when she lost her singing voice and how that gave her new purpose, why she sees herself as a Trojan horse, and how she's using that to make big change, how Jennifer's voracious learning allowed her to become an expert in her own business, and why it's crucial to understand the difference between diversity and inclusion.
This is Million Dollar Mind, remarkable stories of transformation and how to shift your mindset to accelerate success with entrepreneur, author, and mindset expert Julia Pimsleur.
Hey, Jennifer, so great to see you.
Hey, good to see you too. Thanks for having me.
I'm so excited to have this chance to talk to you because we see each other at events. We've known each other for many years. And I'm like, now I get to ask her all those questions.
Oh, excellent. I can't wait.
Good.
Let's dig in.
Let's do it. So I know you just came out with your second book, How to Be an Inclusive Leader. And I'm going to read the little subtitle too, because it's great. Your role in creating cultures of belonging where everyone can thrive. And I know that, you know, what you work on at your company is helping companies have a more inclusive work culture. Mm-hmm. And that's something that is at the forefront of everyone's minds, or should be today, but more and more is part of the conversation.
Yes,
of what is
sure.
success, how do we build thriving companies. And I know you've worked with Wells Fargo and L'Oreal and Kroger, some really big companies and some smaller companies, mm-hmm, to help mm-hmm. them figure this out. Mm-hmm. So I want to start from this place. You said in the book, it is so exhausting to do this suppression of self. What does that mean?
That's right. Well, so there's many people that are downplaying and minimizing and not bringing their full selves to work, depending on what's okay to bring to work. And we make that decision many times a day, a year, depending on what we see and we think is okay in terms of the people we see around us, and particularly leadership. Which is a specialty of mine. So I hail from a community, which is the LGBTQ community, that hides ourself routinely at work. In fact, most people don't understand that 50% of us are closeted in today's workplace. So one out of every two. So that's some intense hiding. And that's a lot of emotional labor. That's a lot of effort. That's and it's not just that community. It's a lot of different often invisible aspects of our diversity stories and experiences and our truth that we do not see normalized around us. And so when we think about it from a company productivity perspective, it becomes a real problem because you have this whole bunch of people who aren't comfortable in a workplace that wasn't built by and for them, right, historically, because the workplace was built sort of for one or two identities that traditionally dominated business since we sort of entered the industrial age. And yet, because we don't see it, we think we can't be it. We think we can't succeed and thrive. We think we can't move up. We're struggling to be seen and heard.
And it's not overt anymore, right?
No,
that's the complicated part.
It's true. So bias, we call it unconscious bias. We call it microaggressions, right? That's a word that we toss around a lot, which is those little acts of exclusion, the little things we say without often without even knowing.
Right. Like, oh, you could bring your wife.
Yeah, exactly. Right? Like, bring your husband or wife, yeah, or tell me about your husband, you know, and being asked that. It's innocent often. I would say more often than not. But it has a cumulative effect of feeling like this workplace and my colleagues don't get me. Like, and I can't really be courageous enough to bring it up because I'm worried that it's going to impact my ability to thrive and be seen as a leader and have executive presence. And so we tend to then not make a big deal about who we are. We tend to assimilate. And that means leaving a lot of who we are out of the frame. And that takes a lot of energy. And so that energy could be going into our productivity and our ability to shine and our ability to build trust with people. But because we're sort of compromising constantly on authenticity, we're tired, we're exhausted. And when that headhunter calls, we ask ourselves, am I really seen and heard here? And can I see a future here? And that's why we see women and people of color and other sort of non-majority identities leaving mainly corporate workplaces in droves, and hence not seeing a lot of diversity at the top in executive suites and boards and all of that. So,
well, and funny enough, in my community, we see such a huge rise of women of color entrepreneurs. That's the fastest growing
segment.
And
where are they coming from? They're right? Refugees from
corporate America, where they're not feeling valued completely.
So it's a real, it's such a
cost. And this is such an important issue, and I want to come back to it and dive in deeper. But I want to go back to where this all started for you. Like, how did you become an advocate for a more diverse workplace?
Yeah, it's interesting. So I was an opera singer. I came to New York to study opera. I injured my voice, and I had several vocal surgeries. So I ended up being forced to leave the field. However, the ability to be on stage and the fact that I'd been on stage my whole life was hugely helpful because now I'm a keynoter and I love the stage. It's the most comfortable place you can put me, which is strange to say. So after opera, I reinvented into the field of leadership development because I just kind of followed some friends who'd been performers and had to reinvent themselves. And I ended up being a trainer, a corporate trainer, which I loved. I taught the entire soft skills catalog, like anything. And lots of things I wasn't even good at,
skill you were teaching?
Like time management and managerial skills and conflict resolution and interviewing skills. It was improvisational. It was very spontaneous. It was I loved it because also I learned so much about what was broken in the business world, because you enter companies and you're literally faced with all of this stuff that's going on, and you absorb it, you think about it. And over time, I was an HR person for a while. Then I went on my own, and I was a corporate trainer and doing leadership skills. And then I'm also LGBTQ. And I was like, well, where does this fit into this whole skill set I have as sort of an organizational development practitioner? And it all kind of just came together in a moment when I realized being LGBTQ is something so valuable to companies. It's a market that the companies want to sell into. And it's also a talent pool that companies want to access. And I could weigh in a first-person way on what it felt like to be closeted. And sort of then I rediscovered it was so much bigger than that. It's all the diversity dimensions. It's my experience as a woman in a male-dominated business world. It's my even experience as a creative artist in a corporate structure where I didn't feel I could even bring that part of myself to work, right?
Did you ever have a moment when you felt this exhaustion of the suppression of self, yourself?
Yes, totally. I mean, I had those, like everybody, we have those coming out stories, right? Where we...
But what was one moment where, like, you were at work and something happened where you're like, ugh, okay.
Yeah. Well, I flew solo and acted as if I didn't have a personal life when I was closeted for years in my insurance company I worked in. And then I worked in fashion for a while in HR. I thought I would find a really kind of open community in that world, but that world had its own challenges. So it was just after a while, I was like, you know, I need to be somebody who can be on the outside and challenge the system. And I think that was the big aha, that I need to have a voice for change. And like, that's my role. And that's how I can be most of service. And so when I finally grappled with that, I created the LLC, I started to hire people, and we started to pivot into this diversity and inclusion space and become a real specialist in it. And then I brought in my knowledge from being LGBTQ and being a woman to now my knowledge of intersectionality, of the experience of people of color, of being an ally for my trans and gender non-binary colleagues within my LGBTQ community. So that's a really interesting flip to focus on diversity within the diversity, but it's a piece that I need to be better at in terms of being an ally.
And Jennifer, were you always an advocate? Like, does this go back to childhood? Were you someone who was always kind of looking for ways to help people or change things?
I think I was, even before I was an opera singer, I was in nonprofits. I was always an activist. I came out of school and I thought, I don't want a job with no significance to it. I really want and need to create change and be part of an organization that is putting something positive in the world, for sure. And, you know,
What was a cause that spoke to you? Like,
I was in community service. Uh-huh. I was working with an amazing youth organization in my 20s. I was making, like, no money, and I was so happy. It was great. It was scrappy. It was full of activists and interesting, smart people. I worked in an organization trying to help those who were coming out of the criminal justice system to get their first jobs. So that was really
amazing. I did
amazing.
That too. That's so funny. That? Were you at the Fortune Society?
No. It's a now defunct nonprofit in Boston. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, I love that. I was actually, when I was a documentary filmmaker, and it was so hard to make these films and raise the money. And I was like, you know what? Let me go work with a population that has even greater challenges. Yeah, right. And it was actually really helpful because I would teach, you know, a room full of people who just gotten out of prison. And like my problem seemed very small after that.
That is perspective taking. Yes. I just returned to a women's prison actually in the Midwest to be on a panel of women entrepreneurs for female inmates. And
it was
so unbelievable.
Like to show them something they could do.
Yeah,
after
and just to talk about our journeys. And the funny thing is, like, every single one of them was taking so many notes. And there was so much we found we had in common, even though they're clearly sort of made that one mistake. Right, that changed their entire lives. And we all realized on this panel that, like, for that one mistake, it could be our experience too. And we're all women, like, trying to survive in a world that doesn't really value us and see us and is full of bias. And
it's multi-layered with race, right?
Oh my goodness,
I mean,
yes.
I already shared on a prior podcast that at 13, at a low point in my life, I shoplifted. But
right.
I was a white girl, right? And I got, the fingers shaken at me as opposed to being thrown into
you got a slap on the wrist and you went.
Exactly.
Yeah,
and so, you know, but there are a lot of people who don't have that story, right? And then wind up in and out of the system. And so, you know, we have to always be paying attention to those issues too. Wow. But I'm curious about the mindset shift that you made going from opera singer to professional. What was that like inside your head?
What it was I thought all was lost, right, when I lost my voice. And I was like, what in the world am I going to do in the world?
Because was it like one day to the next? Or
you know, I injured myself several times through training because it's so tough, and then had surgery and then was totally silent, literally, because you have to recover. And that's terrifying. You never know if your voice is going to come back. And that was the sort of dark night of the soul. I mean, honestly, it was like, how am I going to do my work in the world? And funny, I thought that was my work, but actually I was meant to use my voice, just not as a singer, right? And so all of these things connect in hindsight, and it's a beautiful moment when you realize, wait a second. But it took a lot of years hence to sort of make that make sense. But I found a career coach who said, you know, you are comfortable on stage, you communicate with audiences, you're really confident, you're very creative, you can sort of be improvisational. Why don't you look into this other field? And she happened to have a foot in that new world and made some introductions for me. And I ended up, you know, going to this second master's degree that I got in organizational development. I met a whole new community professionally. And I fell in love with something new that I could do, but that I had tons of kind of translatable skills to bring.
Yes.
And so the mindset, I think, is that the flexibility to understand that you're always building towards where you're going next. You may not see the connection points, but there are translatable skills that you are developing at any moment in any role. And it's a question of repackaging them and writing about them in a different way and selling yourself in. And this is the piece. You've got to figure out how to rebrand yourself, but never lose sight of what you're bringing along with you from those previous, because nothing is wasted. That's the thing I came to realize. There was so much learning. It just wasn't necessarily for the career I thought it was going to be.
Right. It's like that Steve Jobs commencement speech about how you can only connect the dots looking back.
That's right.
Right. When you're going forward, it seems so random. And what does this thing
have
to do with
that thing? And why is this happening to me? There is a reason. And funny enough, I think you need to listen to what the universe is giving you and telling you, because I think, not to be too woo-woo, but I think my voice—
You can be a little woo-woo in here.
Little, okay.
Yeah.
It's a safe space.
Yes.
I think the universe took my voice. I think it was— Jennifer, this is not what you're intended to do, and you're not listening. Haha. So we're going to deprive you of what you think is your means to make a living, and the thing that you are so invested in. You're going sort of 150 miles per hour this way. We're going to literally bring you to your knees because you're not listening. We're going to take it away, and we're going to force you to reinvent, and you'll be okay because you've got some raw materials that will always be useful to you. And funny enough, to become a keynoter, I never saw this for myself. Like it would have shocked me. And yet I slid into it now and I love it. And I feel like it is what I am meant to do. And I could do it for days. And I have so much runway. And I'm so like ahead of the game as a keynoter because like—
Yeah, you bring this whole background of performing.
Yeah, totally. So it's just like, wow, it was all meant to be.
So that's a great mindset shift. It's like reframing what something means, right? It's not that something was taken away. It's that it opened up the possibility to invent into a new you.
Exactly.
Yeah. And are you still making mindset shifts today?
Oh, yeah.
Let's hear about what's going on with your business.
Mind shifting today.
Yeah. Well, tell us a little bit about your business and like what kind of mindset shifts you've made as you've grown. Because I know you've grown really fast.
I have. I have a team of like 25 now. We're all virtual.
The business is in the multi-millions, right?
Yeah, awesome. For sure. So we've cracked a lot of those thresholds that we were talking about the $1 million revenue threshold, which is so tough. You know, I've been a very, very high trust leader. I've dug really deep financially to hire really senior people because I've understood that my gifts are very specific. I can't be all things to all people. There's many, many aspects of being a CEO that I'm not great at, that I don't have the bandwidth to master. And so I have always been thinking about how can I build my team and trust that team, let them run, and how can I then go and create the brand and be on the front end and be the evangelist. And that is my happiest role. It is my activism, but it's also paired with my love of the stage and my ability to use my platform for good. And then the sort of goodness of that accrues to the team that can actually execute on the appetite that I'm building on the front end and the interest and the inspiration that I'm generating, because that's my gift, honestly. And it's a very narrow gift because you think about the capabilities of a bigger consulting team. A lot of those things I used to do because it was just me before I built the team. But now everybody hopefully is in their sweet spot. I have like project managers, I have really analytical people, I have researchers, I have salespeople, I have consultants who have infinite patience for the diversity and inclusion conversation in a way that I think I don't.
But it's so great that you have that self-knowledge, you know, of like, this is the part I'm good at, this is the part I love. And, you know, I am often asked, like, what keeps women from scaling up their businesses?
Oh my gosh.
I say a lot of it has to do with not figuring out what is my genius work and how to create a company that enables me to do that and outsource the rest. So how were you able to do that? How were you able to honor yourself in that way, really?
I have relied on people who could see what I could be before I could see it myself.
Tell me about that.
I think we don't see ourselves in our brilliance. I think women, and the reason for that is we don't see a lot of role models. So if you had stopped 10 years ago, I had no idea what was possible for me because I couldn't see it. And there were no books written about how do you build a multi-million-dollar consulting business. So I literally had no guidance and no one I could emulate. Particularly LGBTQ, for sure. I still don't have anyone I can emulate. I'm like the only one at my level.
Right. People are emulating you, I'm sure.
Well, I hope so. Yeah,
so who was that person who saw you?
Well, I had a first very early on. I had a COO, CFO, straight white guy, much older than me, dug deep, hired that person at a six-figure salary and said, please, please, please do my strategic plan, build my processes and my operations and my financial practices, make sure that we're safe as a company, make sure that we're growing in a scalable way. And the strategy piece was really cool. We got all of my friends and loved ones in a room and we said, who's Jennifer? What does she stand for? And what could this business be in 5 years? And we did a whole strategic plan and I looked at it and I didn't believe it. Guess what was in there? Books, team, global reach.
All the things you're doing
on
now.
Speed dial.
Yes.
And I was like, no way. This is never going to happen. How are we going to get from here to there when I had no team, no books, no, right? So anyway, but it's all happened. So we have to be careful what we wish for, first of all, which is really neat, though, because intention is powerful, putting that plan in place. But I think for women and people of color and other underrepresented founders, we cannot see it around us. And this is the importance of those of us who have achieved some of these things the hard way, which has definitely been true for me. It took way too long to get to where I am. And I've made some very expensive mistakes. And I've had to go deeply into debt. And I've almost lost my company several times. And all of those things, I think, happened because I wasn't protected. There are so few of us. We don't know how to protect ourselves. We don't even know to protect ourselves. And then we don't have people looking out for us to say, don't hire that person. Your expense structure is too large for the revenue that you're generating. Like literally, as an opera singer, I was so vulnerable. And yet I had this giant dream. And so my wish is to save, and I know you're working on this, it's to save entrepreneurs from the disasters when you don't have exposure, when you're not following a script because there is no script, when you don't know how to ask for help, when you don't have the people in your network that have been there and done that and can basically be looking over your shoulder, your advisory team, your board of advisors to basically keep you safe. You're at a lot of risk. So, and I wish, you know, if my team would let me, I would write this next book, which would be How Did I Build This Business? And what were the mistakes I made? And what do I wish that I'd done differently? But they won't let me because they want me to focus on diversity and still kind of feeding that. Because
I think
important.
I think you're going to get there. I'm predicting you're going to get
there.
Yes,
because I have to tell the story because it's taken too long. It's been too expensive. I've almost gone out of business. I trusted the wrong people. I just didn't know, you know, and now I have this healthy, well-run, not dysfunctional, totally loyal and awesome team. And I am the healthiest we've ever been. And I am more secure than I've ever been. But it was way too hard to get here.
What was the mindset part of that? Because my theory is that success in business is 80% mindset, 20% skill set and network. Because if you have your mindset dialed in and you believe you can do it, then you'll go get or hire the skills you hired,
true, right? And you'll go
do the networking with the people you need to meet in order to take your business to the next level.
True.
So how did you keep your mindset strong through all these ups and downs?
Yeah, it's really hard. I mean, I had to kind of literally scrape my company off of the floor several times. You got to be so tough and so resilient, and you have to continue to believe even when you're in despair and even when you've been betrayed. You have to continue to believe, and I believed that my voice somehow deep down was important enough and unique enough that needed to be in the world so that other people could hear it and see it. And somehow I had the financial resources, thankfully, and this is where privilege comes in. You know, I was able to save my business. I had a mortgage I could take a second mortgage out on, you know, but this is what I mean, that those of us who get through the net do so because of the resilience and also because of some resources we have in reserve that we can literally, you know, resurrect ourselves. So the mindset, the toughness, the resilience, but I would tell everybody, just because you have a big dream, you need very robust financial management. When you're trying to scale a company, it becomes more complex. You cross that $500,000 mark, you cross the $1 million mark. You must be well managed. And for visionaries, we're often not the operational managers. So
we need to surround ourselves with those people.
Yes. You must.
And that is
yourself.
Part of also honoring, like, this is what I'm amazing at.
Right.
Like, my genius work, as he calls it in The Big Leap.
Right? And just make sure you're growing in a healthy way. Like, this is the advice I would give you. And if that means slower growth, that's okay. Don't take on investors if you don't feel like you are ready to answer to people. And also don't let people push you around. You know?
How did your mindset have to change along the way? Like, how do you think differently about yourself and your business? But really yourself,
yeah.
Now that it's a multi-million-dollar business than when you first started out, let's say.
Yeah, well, we learn going from nonprofit activist to opera singer to corporate person, nothing equips you for the entrepreneur journey. So, you know, make sure you treat it as the serious discipline that it is. You know, you and I met, I think, in EO.
I think we did.
Entrepreneurs Organization, the Accelerator Program. Make sure that you are learning the discipline of running these functional areas of your business and also the mindset shift of believing in yourself. It took me a long time to kind of trust my vision and embody. I think what other people saw for me, I wasn't quite there.
What helped you get there, Jennifer?
I think of the people that believed in me before I saw myself was like the training wheels. So listen to what people say and see in you, because you may not be ready to see it. But I'm always really interested in how is my brand perceived in a way that I can't see it. And then, you know, do that due diligence, you know, ask the question, what do you think I'm capable of? And what's the need? What is the need that I could go after that I could actually try to solve? Like, how big is it? And listen to people who have that special talent of seeing your gifts and believe them, you know, and then go towards that and sort of, and then like shape your world around that. You may be a different kind of visionary than me. I wasn't able to see it. Other people are like, I'm going to do this and I'm going to still be doing this 10 years later. I didn't know that. So we're all different. You know, we're all, I think, in this confidence continuum of and clarity continuum, really. And some of us, it's an iterative process to discover our true gifts and what we need to be in service of in the world. And so for some of us, you're going to need to kind of go from the outside in. And that was my process of seeing myself.
Right, letting people hold up a mirror
exactly.
And saying, here's what you can be, even if you don't feel like you're there yet.
This is where you're going to be, Jennifer. Yes. And like living into that, breathing into that, saying, what does that feel like? You know, trying that on.
Did you ever do any mindset work?
I think it was all mindset work.
like with a coach or reading books? Or
Reading books, yes. But I just listened to my market. I, as an LGBTQ person and somebody who felt I didn't have a voice, it became and is still sort of an obsession about the workplace needs us and who are the clients that I could serve to help them build these systems that would include somebody like me. You know, what kind of circumstance and workplace would I feel comfortable bringing my full self to work? And who do I represent now? All the people who don't bring their full selves to work, I have them in me. And I feel very much like the Trojan horse. You know, I'm wheeled up to the castle walls. And if I can sort of get into the castle, I can create that change because of perhaps the privilege I carry, which was not earned by me. It's the accident of birth. It's the family, the color of the skin I was born into, the education I had access to, the support I had to believe in myself, the financial resources that I have been lucky to enough to have had. But now I understand my role is actually to give voice to the voiceless.
And the world is catching up with you because you've been doing this work for a while.
You know, I've been waiting for so long for people to care.
Yes.
And it's been this is the other advice I'd give. My mindset was way ahead. And in a way, it was way too far.
People weren't thinking about diversity and inclusion as the top of the list.
And they weren't ready to spend the money on it. And that makes your life as an entrepreneur like really difficult. I think you've got to constantly be one step ahead, but not 10 steps.
Right. Because you're not or they won't have the budget for
it. You're not going to be able to pay the bills.
That's right.
And so you may be brilliant in terms of your ability to perceive what's around the corner, but you've got to meet your market where it's at. You've got to meet your clients where they're at. And so the mindset shift too is being able to hold these two things at the same time, being able to see way down the road of where we're going, but running a business that literally is like servicing the need now, because you need to be able to pay people. You need to be able to pay yourself. You know, you need to be able to do the work so you can demonstrate your brilliance.
Right. You need to be solving a problem people know they have,
right.
Not convincing them they
exactly.
have a problem and
exactly.
then saying, I'll be the one to
so
solve
that,
it.
I think that might be where my sort of activism might have gotten in my way.
Interesting.
A bit, because I was
you
ready.
Were like, I care so much. Why aren't they with me
right.
yet?
And then the why and the convincing and the cajoling and the, you know, presenting the business case for diversity like we all have had to do sort of endlessly.
Coming up, what's at stake in understanding the difference between diversity and inclusion? If you've been listening to this podcast and thinking you might want some help with your own Go Big mindset, you can get a free 45-minute Accelerate session with us, and we'll help you figure out where you're at in your business and where you need to go. Just go to scalewithjulia.com. That's scalewithjulia.com. There's a 20-minute free video training there and a place to set up a call with us. This call could be the first step in getting closer to the life you imagined when you started the business. Mention the Million Dollar Mind podcast. We'll send you a free chapter from the book Million Dollar Women, all about delegating. We look forward to hearing about the changes you'll make in your business after reading it. Set up a call at scalewithjulia.com. Well, now that it's gotten a little easier to at least get the Trojan horse to the door and you're in there having
there.
These conversations,
I'm, yes.
I'm very curious, what are some things that you see companies doing, both small companies, you know, entrepreneurs maybe running 500,000
million-dollar companies, who are a lot of our listeners, and the Wells Fargos and the L'Oreals. Like, what is the conversation that's being had that you think will move the needle? Let's go to the positive. I'm sure there's a lot that's still broken.
Yeah. No, but there's so much positive. I think, honestly, we've all woken up in the last couple of years to the fact that, you know, progressiveness, inclusion, equality, those things don't just – they're not just going to happen. You can't just ride the train without kind of helping build the train as we go. And you can't just leave the building of the train or the maintenance of the train to those of us who have not been traditionally heard and seen. This is a really important point. We are tired. And I'm not even half as tired as a lot of other people who have sort of multiple intersecting identities where, you know, I walk in the room and I'm a woman of color. So I'm managing not only being a woman in a sea of male leaders, but I'm also a person of color and dealing with microaggressions. And then let alone maybe if I'm also LGBTQ, but that is something I really need to hide, right? So if we're all sort of doing this work and we care and we're pushing our organizations and we're trying to educate and we're dealing with kind of hanging in there, you know, I think the bigger message now is that we all have this opportunity to, I like to say, many hands make light work.
And we have this opportunity.
Yeah. So that's why I wrote the second book. It's literally no shame and blame. It is no kind of you're a bad person because you don't understand this, or you're a bad person because you said the wrong word, or you didn't know what a microaggression is, or you didn't know how you're unwittingly kind of participating in a system that is unequal. I mean, it just is. So,
and even small companies are having this conversation.
For sure. I mean, small companies are actually, they have the biggest opportunity and I think the biggest risk. The big risk for small companies is we're grabbing people because we're growing. And I'm going to grab people from my network. I'm going to grab people that went to the same school as I did.
Even though we know that diverse teams perform better, right?
We don't have them in our network and we're in such a rush. And we feel like everything is on the line, right? And so in our minds, we think, well, if I can vouch for this person because I know them and I hang out with them and their family on the weekends and they also went to my school, I think, and this is not necessarily true, that I can entrust this and I'm in such a hurry to grow. So it's very transactional. It's like build, build, build. And bias takes like just a moment, not a lot of time, but just a moment to slow down, to pause, to say, maybe let me think outside the box because this founding team is critical. If I can get diversity of identity and experience and thought here, then it's going to make it exponentially easier to create more innovative products and services, to have customers look at us and say, well, they get it because I see visible diversity, which is critical. And for new hires in the future, as you grow from 10 people to 20 people to 50 people, if I see somebody that looks like me on your team, I'm going to give you more benefit of the doubt. If I'm interviewing with you, I'm going to say, well, I clearly see that diversity is important to you. And therefore, I extrapolate that to mean that I'm going to be able to thrive here.
Yes.
Now, but diversity is nothing without inclusion. So the difference is diversity is being asked to the dance, and inclusion is being asked to dance. So you can have a ton of diversity, but you can be a horribly exclusive organization if you're not paying attention to how is all of our diversity embraced, invited, welcomed, facilitated.
How does the culture change because there is inclusion, not just, hey, why don't you guys come fit into this culture we have going.
It's not just window dressing. It's not just checking the box. It's literally like, but how, on a day-to-day basis, how do I feel that I belong here? And that's a very different question. That's a how question. And to me, that's a leadership question. And that's something we all can get better at.
Well, I hope people will read your book so they can get better at that.
I hope so, too.
I know you're making a lot of big changes in the world. I am curious about the stats. Help me understand what's at stake for companies if they don't get this right.
So much. Well, like we talked about, the big companies are losing diverse talent fast. I mean, the numbers have not changed. We still see people of color represented in the single digits in tech. So Twitter, Facebook, Google, all those companies that like to think they're awesome at this because they're young and hip and they have, you know, all these perks. It doesn't matter. When you look around and you see unchecked bias at every moment of your life and you don't see anybody else that looks like you and you're one and only, it is hard to
That's
say.
It's not going to be a company you might want to
stay
at.
Hard to say. And for women, we're represented in the teens in technical roles in all of tech. So we are leaving in droves. And that's a problem because companies are trying to build products and services for a diverse world.
And how does that hit the bottom line? Do companies that don't figure out the diversity piece not perform as well?
I think that there's a huge blind spot about performance. I think the belief is that, oh, we're a great place. We're a meritocracy. People feel great here. Everybody feels they can contribute in the same way. And so there's this willful blindness to the problems. And the reputational damage is really intense. The loss of talent impacts the ability for teams to be innovative because they have sameness around the table. And the losing of an employee costs 2 to 3 times what somebody's salary is, literally. And so, but companies like to not count these ROI impacts. Like they just, I think they view people as sort of a soft metric. But I think we have to think about metrics in a much bigger way and think about the unseen and untalked about cost. And we need to measure reputational cost and brand cost and the inability for companies to then turn around and recruit more women and people of color into technical roles who literally are looking at this company and saying, I don't want to work there. I've heard horrible things.
And what about on the positive side? Are there companies that have changed up their inclusion and diversity policies and then seen actual gains and growth?
Totally. But it's not tech. Usually not tech. Funny enough, you'd be surprised. You'd be surprised. It's old school industries who have set targets. They said, we will reach gender parity by 2025. We will eradicate our pay gap, like by this year.
Salesforce just did that.
Yes, indeed. And Mark Benioff is one of my favorite CEOs. I mean, he's very transparent about the pay gap that he was shocked to learn about at Salesforce.
Brought to him by a woman employee, yes,
exactly.
By Cindy.
And he was in denial because he's like, wait a second, not on my watch. Like, how could this have happened? And literally wrote a $3 million check to gross it up, number one, but knew that it wasn't just the writing of the check. It was literally the sort of unearthing of how did this happen in the first place? What in our system sort of passed by and we didn't notice it? We didn't care enough to notice it. We didn't ask the right questions. We perpetuated it without even thinking it was wrong. Right? And that's falling on your sword pretty publicly. And so now he has controls in place where they do pay audits all the time. They actually acquire 50 companies a year or something like that and acquire all of their pay gaps. So now they literally have to go through this audit process.
And I think he's challenged other CEOs to do the same.
He has. I wish we saw more. I mean, he's in an industry that thinks it's perfect, right? And there's so many problems in tech. It's horrible. And it's almost worse because you have founders and young people who think that they're well-intended, that think they're progressive, that think this doesn't take work. It literally takes work to be an inclusive leader. I don't care what generation you're in. And by the way, being LGBTQ, we have tons of inclusion problems in our community. I mean, I can tell you about
sexism, no one gets a pass.
Racism and transphobia in our community. And we're supposed to know better, and we don't. So literally, we all have work to do just because you have a sort of marginalized identity or you're in sort of a cohort and you are a 20-something, maybe you're a 20-something straight white male. You've been exposed to what better looks like. But if you don't hold yourself accountable, it's not just going to happen. You need to make it happen. And especially you need to make it happen, because I think we need to see leaders that look like that making it a priority. For Mark Benioff to do that is hugely different than like a female CEO saying the same thing. Mark is going to be watched and he's hopefully going to be emulated by people that look like him. And sadly, you know, we can emulate women all day long and leaders of color all day long, but if men follow what other men are
doing. And as you pointed out, there aren't very many of them.
So right, exactly.
That's going to be a short day, Jennifer.
Yes, indeed.
All day long.
So.
Let me ask you, where are you going now with the company and what's your vision for like the next 5 to 10 years?
That's a great question. I'd like the consulting business to continue to grow. There are so many clients that need our help. We're continuing to serve all sizes of clients. There are industries that almost never come to us. Like I'll tell you one is construction. Just a totally sort of early stage industry where we are really at the beginning and there's so much possible and there's so much runway. So we'd like to broaden the client base. I'd like to broaden the team. I'd like us to become even more sort of the thought leaders of the industry. And then I would like to do more and more and bigger keynotes. I'd like to take this message to audiences that have never heard it before. And so I'd like to get out of the diversity and inclusion world, which I know incredibly well and I love. And it's like a warm bath, you know, standing in front of people who already care about it.
Yes.
Yeah. But I think the real need is to broaden into new audiences. And I think I'm the one to do that. I mean, the Trojan horse metaphor is that they, you know, they're looking at the Trojan horse and they're thinking, oh, what a beautiful horse. Like, let's bring that horse in and, like, you know, like, find out more.
And you're like, I want you to look at all the things you've been trying not to look at.
And you sort of open the floodgates and you're like, and guess what? Like, you know.
Well, let me ask you a question. Is there one thing that if I could say, okay, magic wand, Jennifer, you get to have one thing that every company in America is going to change in the next 5 to 10 years because of your work? What's one thing that everyone could be doing that would actually have an impact?
What's the one thing?
On diversity and inclusion. I'm sure there are 10 things, but if you had to pick just one. Is it about the hiring? Is it about the changing of the culture? Is it about the making it safe to talk about times that you feel excluded?
You know what? I hate to answer it this way because representation isn't the end all be all. It is about inclusion and the how and the culture. But if I saw parity of representation in leadership roles at the C-suite and I'd say the next couple layers down, and I'd like to see gender parity, I'd of course like to see pay equity, and not just gender parity, but with people of color at the high levels and on boards, that would shift everything.
So like the way Germany's done or other countries in Europe where they say you have to have
like 40% women on boards in public companies. And literally America is allergic to quotas, like allergic. In fact, it was like this huge thing and sad at the same time that California – has now a law that's going to be enacted, I think, next year or something. It's like, have one woman on every public company board. I'm like, really? That's the bar. So we are so allergic to these things. And yet I like to say Europe found the women, right? They are findable. We are there. And by the way, it didn't ruin companies to have 40% of us on boards of public companies.
Right. They're probably doing better.
So I honestly think that if we could normalize what diversity looks like in these leadership roles, I think a lot of things would be so much easier for me to do, for my team to do, because we wouldn't be that token woman, that token person of color. We wouldn't just be, oh, that's the HR or the marketing person on the board. We would inhabit business unit P&L roles, right? We would – and talk about role modeling. I mean, to see that this was possible for all of us that are laboring to sort of understand, could I be a CEO someday when I don't see anyone that is holding an executive role?
Absolutely. Like, and I know studies show that when a minority group hits about 30% of a community.
Yes, critical mass.
Critical mass, right?
Absolutely.
Then a lot of the issues start going away.
And then you can be seen as more than the diversity hire.
Yes. So, Jennifer, what's one thing you've read or seen or heard recently that had a big impact on you?
I would recommend Lily Zeng's work. Her last name is spelled Z-H-E-N-G. She wrote a book called Gender Ambiguity in the Workplace. She's a professor at Stanford. She's an incredible advocate, transgender woman of color. And I would start there. It's a really quick read. And I would think about your own, if you don't identify as trans or a member of the LGBTQ community, where can you aspire to be an ally for that community, meaning asking the right questions in your workplace, making sure you're prepared for the people who would transition in your workplace if it were comfortable to do so? Because there's a lot of people that aren't ready to do that, and they're looking for signals to say, is this a welcoming workplace for people like me?
Thank you for leaving us with that book recommendation. I'm excited to check that out. And I'm so happy we got to talk about diversity and inclusion today. And I hope everyone will get Jennifer's book, How to Be an Inclusive Leader. And thanks for leading the charge on this.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening today. And I'll see you on the next Million Dollar Mind. In the meanwhile, go big and stay brave.
Million Dollar Mind is a production of Mouth Media Network. Copyright 2020, Julia Pimsleur.